Thanks, Ida. Okay, good to see you all again. Just while I set up my iPad, I want to talk today about mission. And the reason is that we've come to the end of our series in Luke, which I think we started at the dawn of the church. And some of you will remember. But we've come to the end of that. And so in September, we're going to be kicking off in Acts and continuing the story. And between now and then, we've had a few visiting speakers, and I asked Andy what he'd like me to speak on today, and he said, well, some of the themes that have come out have been mission and prayer. Pick one of those. I chose mission. I think prayer is really difficult to speak on, and I'll leave that to the boss. So I think Andy's going to speak to you on prayer in June. But I want to talk specifically, actually, about mission, and in particular, hospitality. And so the question I want to ask you is, can you remember a time when you were just made to feel incredibly welcome? What was the best moment of hospitality that's ever been extended to you? Can you remember what that felt like? Maybe you were a newcomer, maybe you were an outsider, a stranger into that situation. Was there a time when you just were overwhelmed with the generosity of the people who greeted you, who brought you in? Anyone remember a time where they felt like that? A few of you. Not everyone. And I'll talk about that later. But some of us can recall that. And I was trying to think of some examples. And one of the examples I immediately thought of was when I was about four, maybe five. And there's something you need to know about me as a 4 or 5 year old. It's the hair. Okay? And I just want to explain this because the hair was such. Firstly, I think in the first 4 years of my life, I ingested a serious amount of hairspray, the L'Oreal gold can that used to come out of my mum's handbag, and just constantly being sprayed and kept into position. And so what would happen is it became like this gingery gold afro. My hair grows out, not down. And so I honestly think this became a point of pride for my mum, and she's here today. I'm sure she's repented of it. But the thing about the hair, I'll give you just because we're family, and just because this isn't being broadcast on the internet, I've asked Tim. Now, this wasn't full hair, by the way. This is kind of like low hair. But no taking photos. I'm going to ask Tim to give a very quick glimpse of the hair. So it's just going to be a fraction of a second. Ready? Blink and you'll miss it. Go, Tim. Oh, sorry, I said blink and you miss it, and I owe Tim a tenner. Oh, yeah, yeah. Rest in peace, Prudence, my first dog. Bless her. What a life she had. Anyway, so that was the hair. Now, the thing about the hair is it appealed to a certain type of person, generally over 70 and generally female, which was fine when I was 5, not so fine when I was 15. But anyway, I'll go on with the story. We were on a train through Sweden, so we went to visit some Swedish relatives, and we got a train, and it was a long, long journey. Actually, we were coming back, and we were given this kind of dead fish type stuff because they thought that was a way of blessing us. I think it's called seal, and it's rancid. And so they gave us some of this, so we had nothing to eat, and we were on this long, long train ride, and a lady on her own, who fitted into the category of being plus 70 and female and breathing, said, would you like to come and share my first class carriage? Now, my parents looked at the carriage and thought there's room for four. She only wanted me. So my parents were left in castle class, and I got to go and sit in a proper old-fashioned first-class carriage with sliding glass doors, and all I remember was sandwiches coming in and out. This Swedish woman, I couldn't understand a word she said, but she just kept ordering more sandwiches. So I just ate sandwiches from the north of Sweden down to the south before we jumped on the ferry. That, for me, was a brilliant time of hospitality and welcome. I was a stranger. I was afroed up to the max and managed to worm my way into first class. Welcome. She didn't know me from Adam, but I ate great sandwiches that day. And so it started a course in my life. Before we talk about hospitality, I want to backtrack a little bit. And if you have a Bible, you can stick a finger in Acts 17 and also in Psalm 39. So I will jump around a bit today, which is not usually what I'd like to do. But before I do that, in Matthew 28, Jesus says, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And if we're talking about mission, that tends to be our kind of hang your hat on this particular peg verse. This is essentially what we exist for. But I just want to say just a thought on this verse. I think sometimes there is a debate about what the word go really means. And the debate really goes like this. Some say that the word go is all about literally picking up your stuff, picking up your life, getting on a plane or on a boat or on a train and going to a different community and living and breathing the gospel there, articulating the gospel there and being on mission. And I want to say that's exactly what the verse means. The word go literally does mean that. And there is such a thing as missionaries, and we have mission partners at Mariners, and some of them are here today, who literally have done that. They've literally picked up their lives and they've gone and lived and been incarnate in a different culture and articulated the gospel there. But the thing is, in the Greek, there's two ways of looking at this verse. And so it does mean go, but it can also mean as you go. And so absolutely there are missionaries who do that, but there are also people on mission because God is on mission where we are. Those are the people that are doing the as you go part. Those are the people who are going to work in the morning, 9 o'clock, wherever that looks like for you, or 8 o'clock in the morning, whatever you're doing tomorrow. It's as you go, you are on mission, because we believe that God is on mission just as much in Gloucester as he is in any other country or part of the world, and that he is reconciling the whole earth into himself. And because he is reconciling the whole earth to himself, the mission of God is carrying on whether we engage in it or not. But it's carrying on in your workplaces, in your offices, in your around your dinner table, in your families. And for most of us, it's as you go. It wouldn't work if we all picked up today and said, we're leaving Gloucester and we're going to go to some foreign land. We need people to stay here. But friends, the thing I really want you to get is that mission isn't an activity that we do. It's a life thing that's already happening around us. And actually, it's far more easier than a program or an intentionality. Because as you go into those places, and we'll look at this in a little bit, so the kingdom is with you. As you go into those hard places, so the kingdom is with you. And I know that some of you are looking at me thinking, well, you don't know what my place is like. You don't know what my workplace is like. And I suspect that for some, it's really, really hard. If you work in the public sector, it's going to be quite difficult, I'm sure, to articulate the gospel. And I'm not advocating for 1 minute that you go in and be inappropriate. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is, if it's a really dark place or a spiritually dry place, it doesn't take a lot to light a flame. It's in the darkness that even the smallest light can be seen. Even an act of kindness or a word here or a prayer there can have unbelievable consequences and effects. And so I want to encourage you that you may not be the missionary, but we are engaged in the mission of God that is already happening here. Two thoughts on that. The first one is in Acts 39. I want to nick something. I'm going to give a recommendation for a book at the end of this. And there's two thoughts, really. It's one of personality and place. Hello. One of personality and place. Is that an alien invasion? Or personality and place. And so we'll talk about personality, then we're going to talk about place. In Psalm 139, it says this. For you formed my inward parts, and you knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret. Intricately woven in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed substance. My frame was not hidden from you, and your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. Frame and substance. Now we know that God has given us the biological ability to make people, to procreate. But we're not deists that just believe that God kind of gives us the ability and then stands back and that we're just allowed to get on with this. In the scriptures, in Psalm 139, what it's saying is that there's something about the frame and the unseen substance of us that is already planned and prepped and linked to the days that are about to be rolled out in front of us. Now, we believe that God is outside of time. And so he already exists in our tomorrow. Do we get that? It's not that he's just outside of time and looks back and just lets this thing roll on. And I'm not a determinist. I don't think it's going to be exactly one particular thing. But he already exists in our tomorrow, and he already exists in our next week. And so he knows how the days are going to go for us. And because he knows how the days are going to go for us, he is keen to ensure that he uniquely wires our frame and our unseen substance. Now, in 1956, there was the Suez Canal crisis. And because of that, that meant that we had this oil crisis in the UK. Anybody around for that? Anybody remember what was happening? Okay, thanks, Dave. Thanks for being brave. So what happened was that people, because of that, petrol was at a premium. And so to get around, cars were obviously kind of in motion at that point. And there was an import of I can't pronounce this very well, but I think it's called the Messerschmitt, which was a tiny little car that was used in the Second World War, German-made, and people were importing them over to the UK in order to get around because it sipped on gasoline. And that was how people were getting around the oil crisis. And the reason we had the crisis, just very quickly, is that the Egyptian president, without any warning, decided to privatize the Suez Canal. The UK and a couple of others thought it would be good to invade. They botched it. The Americans didn't back it. And then when they botched it, essentially, Saudi Arabia punished us with this reduced amount of oil. There was a chap called Leonard Lord, who was the head of the BMC, the British Motoring Company, and he was outraged by this, that not just long after the end of the Second World War, that we were suddenly importing this German product and using it and not using British stuff. And so he wanted a car to be built that would get around this issue of being able to transport people, but transport a family, so it had to seat four people, to sip on fuel and resources, and to be less than 10 feet long, because he was concerned if it was too big, people wouldn't like it because they were used now to smaller things. And so there was a guy called Alec Issigonis. Thank you very much. Alec Issigonis, who designed the Mini. Now, the thing is, when he designed the Mini, they knew how to build cars, and they had all the components to build the car, and they could have just thrown this thing together, and they could have just built a car and sent it out of the factory and rolled it onto the roads. But when they built the car, they built it knowing what was about to come. They built it knowing the environment that the car was about to go, and they knew what it needed to do. They knew what the challenges were going to be. And so they built the components carefully, intricately designed with purpose so that it could meet the challenges and the environment. And friends, that's exactly how God puts us together in the womb. He knows the days that are about to come. And so when we think about mission, and when we think about God being on mission, and when we think about mission in the workplace and what's happening, I want you to know that it's almost criminal to pretend that you're anybody else. Because God has equipped you knowing where you would be, knowing what the challenges would be, and has intricately given you the frame, the unseen substance, the personality, in order to be on mission in that place. That's really good news. You don't need to be something that you're not. If you are an extrovert, great. If you're an introvert, great. If you're a loud or quiet or a peacemaker or a doer or somebody who makes things happen, all of that has been given to you for the circumstances that are happening right now and for the circumstances that are going to happen tomorrow. The second thing is place. Now, in Acts 17, if you got it, we can quickly flick there. I'm just conscious of time. I'll just read this. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man. This is verse 24. Nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way towards him and find him. Having determined allotted periods and boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way towards him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. he is actually not far from each one of us. Now, what Paul is not saying in that scripture is something about God's omnipresence. He's not saying, although that is true, that God isn't far from all of us. That is true. He is omnipresent. The meaning of the text is that he's not far from each one of us because we are there. That he has predetermined boundaries and times and dwelling places, and that the places we are, the people around us, are not far from God because we are there. Which should be the answer to any concerns about what it is we're supposed to do as Christians, or any concerns of Christian boredom. Because the reality is that wherever you go, wherever you work, wherever you eat, wherever you socialize, wherever you do fun things and hobbies and all that stuff, as you go, the mission of God is happening. You've been intricately built and designed to be in that place, and that he has already ordained the very locality of that place. Now, there's a thing going around at the moment about thin places. Anybody come across this? And basically what it is that people say there are thin places of the presence of God. And some of those might be, for example, churches or cathedrals, or it may be certain gatherings of people where it's a thin place. And you could say Sunday mornings is a thin place where we sense and feel the presence of God, and hopefully we've done that this morning. But friends, I want to tell you, you are a thin place. You are a thin place, which for somebody like me to be put in the same sentence as the word thin is radically good news. But all of us are thin places, because where we are, for the others who don't know him, they are not far from God. He has preordained who you are, the hidden traits, the intricate things that make you you, and he has placed you in that position. That's the mission of God. And you might say, well, I'm thinking about leaving tomorrow and I'm going somewhere else. Yep, he knew that. And he'll be there as well. And he's equipped you for that as well. And he's on mission there before you've already got there. It's already happening. And how much we engage in it is up to us, but it's already taking place. Now, in hospitality, the reason I want to draw attention to hospitality is this. I think we've lost the art of the beautiful simplicity of hospitality. And we spend, or I do, loads of time thinking and praying and sometimes resources around evangelism and how we can engage in people. And some of that is really, really good. I'm a massive fan of Alpha. I literally love it. Just absolutely love Alpha. And I'm a massive fan of what's going on here, where we're meeting people coming in the church and just asking them some questions about them and engaging with them. But also, there's loads of stuff, and I think sometimes we get so hesitant about how should we evangelize, and how should we meet people, and how should we greet them with the gospel, and how should we engage them. There's books, millions and millions of, well, not millions, but it's probably millions of books written on that very subject. And I think we've lost the beautiful simplicity of hospitality. Now, the other thing is, I think the word hospitality has been hijacked slightly by Mary Berry. I love Mary Berry. But I think when we think of hospitality, nearly all of us will think of food. We'll think about, well, some people are gifted in hospitality because they're really good cooks, and when you go around there, you know you're going to get a full meal. They're really, really good at hospitality. And probably they are. But hospitality in the scriptures is nothing to do with food, although that can be a vehicle. Hospitality is nearly always to do with LinkedIn to inviting and welcoming the outsider, the stranger, the person on the fringes. That's what hospitality is. Hospitality also is not fellowship. We're really good, or I'm really good at spiritualizing stuff and saying it's something that it's not. And so sometimes when we hang out with Christian brothers and sisters and we have a good meal, I think, well, we've ticked the hospitality box. That's fellowship. That's not hospitality. It's always the welcoming of the stranger and the outsider. Just a few things about what hospitality is. For some, it is a gift. For some, you are just really, really good at it. You spot people who are on the fringes. You may have done it this morning, over the last few weeks, and you're really, really good at connecting with them. Maybe you're good at welcoming them. Maybe you are good at providing for their needs. For some, it is a qualification. It is a qualification for leadership. In 1 Timothy, it tells us this. Now, to be honest, if we'd have written up a job description for leaders, probably most of us wouldn't have thought about hospitality. But we're told clearly that if you aspire to leadership, hospitality is a qualification. The ability to spot the outsider, to spot somebody who's on the fringes, and to welcome them in and to create space. It is also a command. Hebrews 13, do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. Romans 5 tells us, carry on doing this. It's a gift, it's a qualification, and it's a command. It's not about fellowship, it's not necessarily about food. But it is always about welcoming the outsider, engaging with them, and seeing the intrinsic value that God has in them. And I just have a hunch that amidst all the different things we could do, that if the church really was able to grasp hold of the essential nature of hospitality, that we would see many, many people come to know Jesus. I think we've lost the art of it. Why is it important? I want to just share three things that may help us. The first thing is that hospitality is countercultural. There was a book written called Bowling Alone, which was quite a controversial book. But this chap who wrote the book did some study about how we live as a community and what we do and how we relate to each other. And he found that in Western civilizations, even things like playing cards together, you know, board games, was down by 30%. That things like pubs and bars were 40% less than they were 25 years ago. Restaurants, 25% less. Fast food, up 100%. Neighborly meals, people invited to a neighborly meal, down by 30%. Family dinners, where everybody eats together, down by 35%. The act of having friends over to a home, down by 45%. And in the UK, around about 10% of people say that they nearly always feel lonely. And you know what? It's not the elderly. The people that are most likely to feel lonely are 16 to 24-year-olds. The generation that are supposedly more connected than we've ever been are saying, I feel lonely. I feel like an outsider. I feel like a stranger. And so, friends, the church has always been called to be countercultural. It's always been called to go against the grain. And we have this wonderful opportunity. We have a field that is rich with harvest of people who feel disconnected. There was a study done in the Telegraph. 25% of people interviewed, and they interviewed a cross-section of society, said that they felt like a stranger in their own neighborhood. Times have radically changed. I know when talking to my parents last night, they can recall their neighbors. They can recall the relationships they had with their neighbors. I can barely recall any of our neighbors. People generally are less likely to engage with each other. The first reason that hospitality is important is because it's countercultural. The second reason is this, and it's the most important, is that it's the story of us all. If I could put in one nutshell, and if you could take away one thing from today, it would be this, that the reason that hospitality is important is because we have all received the greatest hospitality known in the history of the world. You see, we worship this God who is all about hospitality. In Ezekiel 16, he gives this word to Ezekiel, and he says, I want you to speak this, and it's about this rebellious Jerusalem people, our forefathers in the faith. And because of their sin and rebellion, they've been left by the father of lies. And it says, you were like a baby who was discarded. You were like a baby who was thrown in the ditch, who was left to die. But I wandered past, and I saw you kicking around in your own blood. And I drew near to you. I engaged with you. And I said, live. and you rose and you became prosperous. And then what happens is as this baby rises, so she continues to rebel against him. But in Ezekiel 36, he demonstrates hospitality again and he comes back again for more. He draws near, he engages with us and he says, no longer do you have a heart of stone. I'm going to give you this heart of flesh. You're going to worship me in a different way. We're going to be intimate together. We're going to get to know one another. It's not going to be the old system. And you will be my people, and I will be your God. And then he comes in the flesh and the meat to dwell among us in the person of Jesus. And he draws the outsiders, the last and the least and the lost, and he eats with them. And he hangs out with them. He engages with them. He goes off to find them. He barbecues with his disciples on the beach as he invites them into mission. Literally, the person who breathes out creation and holds all creation together, barbecuing, grilling steaks on the beach and hanging out with human beings. That's the kind of hospitality and the kind of God that I want to worship. And then he tells us about this great Samaritan and this person who was left at the side of the ditch, this person who was left beaten and downtrodden and had nothing. And this great Samaritan, who was a stranger, sees the person in the ditch and they draw near to the person and they raise that person up and they restore him to full health and to full well-being. And then he talks about the son. The son who said, I'm not part of this family anymore. And in his sin and rebellion, he goes off in a different direction. And when he comes home as a stranger because he's coming home as a slave. But he tells us about the father who rushes to meet him and he engages him and wraps his hands around him and says, welcome home, son. And he restores him to his rightful place. And then in Romans 5, we're told that whilst we were enemies of God and whilst we were still sinners that Christ died for us. And in Ephesians 2, that we were cut away from the kingdom, that we were left outside of the kingdom and we were far off, but he invites us in. And then in Ephesians 5:27, we were like the widowed bride, but the son, Jesus, sees his bride as the church and he becomes the perfect groom. And in Revelation, there's going to be the feast of all feasts, where because of the single greatest act of hospitality, where Jesus, who knew no sin, became sin so that we may know the righteousness of God, we will come together again and we will be in that place where we will know the full hospitality and nature of him in Revelation at the end of this particular earth. You see, friends, when we needed a rescuer, when we were downtrodden, when we were left, we inherited the perfect rescuer. When we needed a forgiving father because of our sin and rebellion, we inherited the perfect father who rushes to us. When we were far off and cut out from the kingdom, we inherited the perfect king who gives us the keys to the kingdom and says, not only citizens, but you are now ambassadors of this kingdom and you carry this kingdom wherever you go. When we were like the widowed bride, we inherited the perfect groom who restores us to beauty. When we were enemies of God, we had the perfect friend. When we were sinners and dead in our sin, we had the perfect Christ. And no greater act of hospitality can there be than we who are finite and sinful and broken being welcomed in to God who is infinite, infinite, and holy. No greater chasm can there be between two bodies than those two things. And yet he engages with us. He demonstrates hospitality. He draws us close. And he welcomes us as part of the family. You see, you can't separate hospitality from the mission. You can't separate hospitality from the gospel. It's not a bolt-on to church activity. Hospitality is like a golden thread that runs right through the middle of each and every one of us who know Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. And so when we talk about it, and the reason it's so important, and the reason it's a command, and it's a qualification of leadership, it's because we've received it. Which leads me on to point three. It brings joy in sharing. You see, the thing about the Christian life, you may have noticed, is that worship should never terminate on us or stuff. So our upward worship to God never ever terminates on us or stuff. That's idolatry. You may be like me and you may love your morning cup of coffee. It literally is like bliss. And as it goes into my throat, I feel like a worship coming up. And I thank the Lord for coffee beans. Seriously, I do, because otherwise it's going to be idolatry. You see, we can live in worship of all things. It's meant to roll up in our affections to Him. But in the same way, the blessing that comes to us should never terminate on us either. It's a principle of the kingdom. Freely you've given, and freely you will give away. And so because we've been recipients of this incredible hospitality, friends, we won't know the full depths of that until we start giving it away more. And practically, that means engaging people. And we engage people because God engaged us. It means making space for people. We make space for people because God made space for us. We welcome people and we embrace them because God welcomed and embraced us. We see the value that they bring, the value that they have, the gifts and potential they have, because God has seen that in us. But if you want to know that more fully, we have to see that roll out from us as well. If you want to know the full extent of the hospitality you've received, you need to give it away. It's a principle of the kingdom. I've just finished with this final thing. So I think the greatest experience of hospitality I ever had was a few years ago. And a friend of ours, Paul, contracted cancer of the esophagus, and he was 30 at the time. It was like a one in a million type thing. And long story short, we were living kind of far away, and I really felt God say, you need to go and pick Paul up, and you need to take him to a church in Solihull, which was led by a guy called Reverend David Carr. I don't know if anybody's heard of Reverend David Carr. Incredible man. And you need to ask David Carr to pray for him. Now, that was a tough gig because I knew David Carr at the time was speaking all over the world. And what was really weird was at the same time, Paul had had a dream. And he woke up in the morning. He said, God, I really feel you want me to see David Carr. Would you make that possible? And through some kind of weird connections, we eventually found out about what God was saying to us. And so, long story short, we went and picked up Paul. And we drove to this church in Solihull. And Paul was very ill. And David Carr said, bring him. I will get there early. We will save a space for you in the car park, and I will see him before the service. And friends, all I can tell you is that the hospitality that was extended to us, I have to tell you, I was undone before a sermon was uttered or a note was sung. It was like being in the presence of God, because it was that we were in the presence of God. And sometimes when we talk about the presence, we talk about things that are vitally important, the worship and how good the preaching is and how good the coffee and tea is and how good we do the welcome bit and all that stuff. But I just wonder, are we scratching the surface on this? Are we really scratching the surface? You see, if we're a community that really grips hold of this, you know, that we really look out for those on the fringes, that we go out of our way to welcome and to draw them in. We bring them into the presence of God before we've done any of that stuff. Because it's His heart and it's His mission at work. But again, I feel like we've lost, at times, the beautiful simplicity of hospitality. Father, I thank You that You have drawn us close, that whilst we were far off, You have engaged us and You have brought us near. And Father, would You shape and grip our hearts? Holy Spirit, would You continue to minister to us? Lord, I thank You for those who are already doing this and for the giftedness You've given to this church. Lord, I thank You that we are known as a welcoming church. Lord, I thank You for things like the galley where we welcome people. And the other ministry is the refugee cafe on a Sunday. Lord, I thank You that there is life that is springing up because of this desire to engage with the outsider, to engage with the strangers. But Lord, would You make this more than just a bolt-on ministry? Would it flow from the knowledge that we have been the greatest recipients ourselves? Lord, may we engage in Your mission. And I thank you that your mission is taking place and that you are at work, reconciling the whole earth unto yourself. In Jesus' name, amen. Great, well. We're going to finish in worship, and if you've any need for prayer, we would love to pray for you. And we've got our first candidate on the front row already. But if there's physical things you'd like us to pray for, there's a prayer team that will come out to the front. If it's something you'd like to respond to in the message, if it's prompted something, or if it's just anything that you feel, you know what, it'd be great to get God's input in on this, then we'd love to pray for you, and there'll be a team of us at the front, or come and find us at the end as well.
Shall we stand together?